Okay, so I'm Rick Hansen, and as you may know, we record these talks. Hopefully, most of them usually work. Occasionally, the microphone brushes against my shirt, and I goof up. But usually we get them, and we post them. So today, anyway, is July 27th, 2016. And you may know from previous weeks here, we've been exploring mindfulness, especially this year. And lately, we've been focusing on the second major place that the Buddha encouraged us to train in mindfulness, which is with regard to the feeling tones of experience, or in modern psychological language, the hedonic tones of experience as pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. And as you may know, I think it's useful to draw attention to arguably a fourth distinct hedonic tone, the sense of things being heartfelt or relational. In other words, it's natural to move toward what's pleasant or away from what's unpleasant, but what if we're neither moving toward something nor away from it, but while resting in a sense of connectedness or not connectedness, having to do with the sense of things being heartfelt, given how social we are as mammals, and frankly, maybe as a bit of a corrective to the intensely male-dominated stream of teaching, wisdom teachings around the world, including in Buddhism. So in any case, we're talking now about being aware of the sense of experience as pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. That's very natural. That really arises. But where trouble begins, as you may have noticed, is when we go to war with what's unpleasant. Right? We fight it. We run from it. We freeze in relationship to it. Or we chase what's pleasant, or we cling to what's heartfelt. That's when trouble begins. And in a lot of ways, what practice is really about is over time, gradually helping ourselves not experience certain things as unpleasant because we're sort of trained to think of them as unpleasant, but instead they are just what they are. But in the moment, you know, it's to develop a kind of inner shock absorber, so that when something happens, when you see someone on television or Huffington Post whose politics you don't like or something like that, or your daughter doesn't call you back for days at a time, or is too busy to Skype with you this morning, right? Or you wanted the last cookie and somebody else got it first, right? When stuff, you know, unpleasant comes up, but do we add fuel to that fire, right? Do we start getting into it? That's the key question. So lately I've been focusing on the unpleasant feeling tone because that's often where there's the most trouble for many people. And also that's where, as animals that evolved, whose nervous systems evolved over 600 million years, we tend to be most activated. Because first and foremost, you know, in the wild, live to see the sunrise, right? Eat lunch today, don't be lunch today. Right, in a nutshell. So I want to talk about the unpleasant sense of things related to three primary needs we have, and in particular, our primary need for safety, the other two being for satisfaction and connection, really broadly defined. So what happens when we feel unsafe, right? Or we feel threatened, you know, bombs are going off somewhere, people are yelling at us. Another person in our environment is getting intense. We don't feel supported. Right now I'm grappling with the ways in which I don't feel, you know, that the resources and my work that supports me in doing it are really as solid as they ought to be, partly related to the fact that people are going on leave or vacation or things like that. What do you do when you feel let down, or you counted on something and it's not there for you, right? What do you do? So that's what I'd like to explore tonight around safety and how to practice with safety. So I want to offer a few suggestions and then just kind of open it up, all right? Okay? And you can relate to this material at a personal level. Obviously, we could very quickly scale up to the political level, the ways in which people grapple with fear and feeling unsafe, and the ways that others sometimes manipulate fears, make people unsafe, because that's a great way, classic in social mammal groups, including us primate humans, it's a classic way to get people to want or put up with some kind of authoritarian leader. It's an old story. Okay. So it's very relevant. I'm going to try to keep it, though, notwithstanding tonight's the night, notwithstanding that, I'm going to try to keep it at the personal level. So safety. First suggestion is, notice when you feel unsafe. Lots of times we push away that little warning inside. I don't feel quite good here. It's a little uneasy. It's a little sketchy. There's some funny feeling I'm getting about that other person. And sometimes we dismiss or numb out or tune out the inner sense of being anxious, uneasy, unsettled, apprehensive. So the first thing, of course, is to track. If you actually feel unsafe. And people can push it away for different reasons. You can imagine being really macho about it, or feeling like you don't deserve to feel unsafe given how comfortable your life is. For whatever reason, you might ask yourself, if I were to open to and be mindful of those background feelings of uneasiness or apprehensiveness or unsettledness or that funny feeling in my gut that this is not quite right, what would I gain from that? What would I gather from that? So that's like a first offering. Second offering is to actually deal with things as sincerely as you can. And that word sincerity is a very powerful word because that's what we can do something about. A lot, we can't necessarily patch all the leaks in our roof. We can't take care of all health problems, particularly eventually. We can't always get other people to come through for us. But our own practice, our own conduct, can be sincere, heartfelt, authentic. That's what we can do. So that's the second question. Can you, in a sincere way, just do the best you can, but really the best you can? I think sometimes in sort of new age word games, people will say, well, they're always doing the best they can. Well, I could think of a lot of people that didn't do the best they could. And frankly, there were times for myself as a dad or a therapist, tired at the end of a long day, or irritated with some person in which I don't think I did the best I could. We can tell the difference. Are we phoning in the performance? Or are we really, without freaking out and stressing out, are we doing the best truly we can? And that's really on us to know. But if we are being sincere, not twisted up, not stressing, the kind of level of effort that's sustainable over the marathon of life, given our real life, are we being sincere along the way? That's a beautiful thing to take refuge in, to know your own sincerity. You're going to make mistakes. I make mistakes. We drop balls. And were we sincere? Or cutting corners, BSing our way through it, not really showing up. Were we sincere? Okay. Third, And taking care of things as best we can. The third suggestion has to do really with how the nervous system works. And the majority of information coming into the brain comes from inside the body because the brain is constantly needing to read out as the master regulator of all the systems in the body. The brain's continually needing to find what's out, what's going on. And what's interesting is that most people's lives, most seconds of most lives, with important exceptions, but most seconds of most lives, if you look backward, like most of the seconds of your life, in that second, second by second by second, you were basically okay, right? In that second. There probably were seconds where you weren't okay. There may be, will likely be, seconds in the future where you're not basically okay, particularly at a body level. Basically okay. It's not a $1 million moment. Your back hurts. You're worried about something. But there's enough air to breathe. You're not starving. You're not in overwhelming pain. You're not being immediately attacked. you're basically okay. And there's an opportunity for us to really tune into that routinely, to feel basically okay. I say feel all right right now. Notice that you're all right right now. There's enough air, your heart's still beating, there's some basically food, maybe you're a little thirsty, but you're really okay. There's a basic all rightness of the body. And that's important for a couple of reasons. So now I want to talk about how we learn and grow from our experiences or contract and are harmed by them. Because we are continually being shaped by our experiences. Certainly embedded in the nervous system and then spreading out in the whole body altogether, right? The body learns as it moves through life, for better or worse. Experiences leave lasting traces behind. And there are four useful takeaways from the neuropsychology of learning that I want to offer here. And I mentioned last week that I would mention these. So the first is we're being primed for new learning. So if you want to set yourself up to really establish a sense of calm strength inside, one way to do it is to establish a kind of priming that's tilted positively. I don't mean positive thinking, pie in the sky, rose-colored glasses, or clinging to anything. I mean, if you set yourself up to repeatedly have a kind of background sense of ongoing all rightness, then when there's a real moment of tranquility or a sense of grit and fortitude, both of which we draw on for safety, or if suddenly you realize there are people who will show up for you, who will back you, who will wish you well, even if you screw up, right? Sources of safety. Then those opportunities to grow and learn and internalize that good event land on prepared ground. Because there's a lot of evidence that we can establish a kind of background priming or readiness to learn before actual learning. I mean emotional learning, attitudinal learning, body learning, motivational learning. We're setting ourselves up so that when the learning opportunity is there, it really sinks in. We're primed to go. Now that goes the other way too. If we have this background sense of uneasiness, anxiety, you know, we're kind of ruminating about an anxious worry, you know, and then when something significant happens, right, like you're driving in your car and, you know, suddenly someone cuts in front of you, or maybe somebody does something that feels alarming to you or shocking or startling, you know, or whatever it might be, that event lands on prepared ground, prepared for negative learning, for fear learning. As animals, we're extremely vulnerable to fear learning because that's the most important thing to learn of all if you want to live to see the sunrise, right? So you get this idea? So that's the first point. Trying to set up an ongoingness, let's say, of all rightness, so when opportunities to really register calm strength and a fundamental core of peacefulness amidst a world that's imperfect and continually falling apart and going to hell in a handbasket, one way or another. Not always, there are many good things that happen, but you know what I mean? It's this weird paradox that you see in very developed people far along. They're incredibly compassionate. They're really present and engaged. Their heart's really open, but in some deep way in their core, they're not rattled by the things that fall apart. There's a teaching from Ajahn Chah. Ajahn is an honorific. It's a title. So Cha in the Thai forest tradition, Jack Kornfield, Spirit Rocks kind of teacher, that stream. He was talking about a cup. And as a monk, he didn't own anything, but he had a cup. It was a beautiful cup someone gave him. And he said, you know, when I see this cup, I see that it's already broken. See? It's already broken. But he's okay with that. He's not disturbed in his core. Okay? Because I'll get to that later, but there's a strong sense of being everything, and everything is always all right, as everything. Inside it is often a lot of trouble, but the totality of everything, allness as allness, is never disturbed as allness. It's always allness. It doesn't ever fall apart. Okay. So, good. So that's the first one, prepared ground. The second one is, when a learning opportunity happens, like registering that you're all right, try to have a little feeling of reward or surge of pleasure or aliveness that goes with it. And that's because in terms of helping yourself learn from beneficial experiences, we actually are learning, and the consolidation of experiences and neural networks is really aided by adrenaline and cortisol. In other words, so-called stress hormones. When we get a little bit revved up, we learn more. We register our experiences more deeply. The trick, of course, is not to tip into trouble with that little bit of revving. Technically, adrenaline doesn't particularly go up into the brain. It activates receptors that send norepinephrine up into the brain, which has a feeling of alerting, orienting. This matters. This is important. So if you have an opportunity around safety to feel protected or reassured or calm strength, or it'll still be okay even if it doesn't all go perfectly, you know, 10 months from now, 10 years from now, 10 weeks from now, this is not going to be that big a deal. Whatever it might be, there's an opportunity for learning. Often we'll understand things sort of intellectually maybe, or we'll have a subtle feeling of reassurance or relief, let's say, or, oh yeah, I could deal with this, but it won't have much intensity to it. And because it doesn't have much intensity to it, it doesn't change us at all. So the trick is to open to a sense of energy with positive emotion. Just because we're having adrenaline and cortisol isn't inherently bad. It's bad in some sense if it's associated with negative emotion. That's the trick. But to be revved up, to be excited that the Golden State Warriors are doing well, managing disappointment when they don't, you know, to have a little sense of, man, it feels good to have this quality of calm strength. Yeah, like, you know, I can count on you. I can be reassured. I can feel relieved here. That feels good. Or I am really actually okay right now. Or, wow, this thing I was worried about, I just got way too deep into it. I got my knickers in a twist about that. Wow. Do what you can to help it be, have a little bit of zip to it. You know, a sense of you could just sit up a little straighter. Sometimes I'll sit up straighter. I'll inhale a little more fully. I'll kind of deliberately stimulate some norepinephrine upstairs, like to help this really land, you know? Or a sense of pleasurable excitement, like, yeah, this is good. Let it, you know, like that. Okay, is that second one? Longtime therapist, I just think back on all the moments in my office where the client was, yeah, that's right, that's good. Like limp, we're both so limp. You're like, yeah, we're so mellow. I thought being mellow was really it. You know, mellow's good, but mellow without some aliveness doesn't sink in, right? That's what I'm talking about. You know, that sweet spot where there's aliveness, there's vitality, there's a little juice in it with positive emotion, even, you know, like subtle positive emotion, like relief or reassurance, rather than just being kind of inert, like, oh yeah, good news. Again. Right? Okay. A second takeaway. You want to help your brain learn. Okay. Third takeaway is there's this key process that happens, especially for many kinds of learning, in which there's a kind of conversation going back and forth between a part of the brain called the hippocampus. There are two of them, one on each side. They look like those little seahorses. That's why they call them hippocampus. And the hippocampus basically is reverberating. It's communicating with the cortex more generally. And what happens over time is that information that's initially stabilized in the hippocampus or experiences become stabilized over hours and days, sometimes even weeks, in the cortex altogether. So the hippocampus is no longer involved. So there's this conversation. Okay. The practical implication of that, and you can watch it in yourself, when you're having some kind of useful personal experience, like feeling, you know, like relaxing, or recognizing that you're okay, or realizing, okay, I can solve this problem that I've been ruminating about by doing this thing, something, okay? When there's that opportunity for helping an experience to sink in, try to relate it to a wider context of meaning. That wider context of meaning will draw on your cortex. And I've started to explore this, and in a funny way, you can feel like it's landing more. Like, for example, relaxation, you know, you feel relaxed, and then in the back of your mind, relate it to a broader idea or maybe an image, because the cortex is mostly nonverbal, right? If you think about how much is dedicated to language processing, it's a tiny fraction of cortex altogether. So like a big picture perspective, so maybe there's a sense of relaxing, and then like how I do it in part is I connect that to a larger meaning, which has, you know, a couple words dribbled into it, but mostly a kind of an image of like, wow, most of the time I've actually really been okay. You know, it connects there. And when you do that, I think it's plausible, and I think there's some evidence for it as well, that you can deepen the impact. Is that clear? You connect it to a wider meaning or a larger context. And you just kind of go back and forth between the particular and the general. That's what I'm really getting. The hippocampus gets very involved in the particularity of this experience. There's a place for that. And then the cortex gets involved in indexing across all kinds of particular moments of life or particular episodes of life to find the generality that's common to them all. That's the takeaway. Sometimes represented in language or imagery. Does that make sense? So you're connecting into that. Okay, so that's the third thing we can do, based on how the brain works, to really deepen consolidation, moving from initial encoding of an experience into consolidating it, initially in the hippocampus and then spreading out into the brain altogether, which of course is intertwining with the body altogether. Okay, and then the fourth thing we can do, and I'll see what you make of all this, there is a period, literally, of days during which our experiences are being consolidated and stabilized. Sleep and slow wave sleep plus rapid eye movement sleep, these two major phases of sleep, are involved in that process in ways that are becoming more and more clear. Also, as we're consolidating, we can reconsolidate again and again and again. Now, that gives us an opportunity, as we reconsolidate, to pull up negative material, like fears and so forth, and then link it in the moment of pulling it up again to something positive, so that when the negative material goes back down the memory hole to be reconsolidated, it's disrupted. And it doesn't reconsolidate so much, so that the next time you get triggered about that, you're not triggered so much. Distinct from that process, I'm talking about consolidating positive experiences rather than disrupting the reconsolidation of negative, neurotic, or whatever material. Okay? And a way to do that is to really appreciate that if you're trying to help an experience land, especially for the first hour or two afterward, even for the first half hour, replay it a few times. Call it up again. Like, oh yeah, the felt sense. What does it feel like, for example, this is a little bit off of safety, what's it feel like to be present, stay present, and know you're present? That quality of sustained present moment awareness, that's the essence of mindfulness. What's that feel like? Okay, we meditated on it, you got it, it's sinking in. 5-10 minutes later, try to remember, pull that one up again, for example. Or maybe you have a sense of dealing with something that was scary and you pulled up a feeling of strength and healthy entitlement inside yourself to deal with that and you thought, wow, go girl, yeah, or whatever. You know, that's good, yeah, all right, good, that was great. And then 5-10 minutes later, try to remember to call up again the body memory of that experience to help it consolidate, because there's this long process of consolidation. And we can accelerate it over the days by repeating it several times over the minutes and hours. It's really appreciating that, I mean, literally, as you sit here, as I sit here, little R2-D2 molecular units in our brains are consolidating beneficial experiences or harmful ones we had yesterday or last week, right? So part of what we do in the moment by having some kind of beneficial experience is to encourage and deepen the consolidation of past beneficial experiences. Makes sense in a funny way? That's one of the major benefits of taking in the good or opening to the good or inclining the mind, as the Buddha said, in a wholesome direction. We both reap the rewards of what we incline our minds to in the moment, and we help previous experiences that were useful sink in even more. Isn't that kind of wild? It's really, okay, so you can help yourself in that way. So those are four ways, grounded in science. I'm doing a deep dive these days and to a whole deeper level of the neuropsychology of learning, emotional learning. And I find that all really, really helpful. And then to finish, I'll finish on this last suggestion and see what you make of all this. I find for myself that usually when I'm getting worked up about the unpleasant, it's also true for the pleasant and the heartfelt, but we're not there yet, there's a lot of I in it. There's a lot of Rick in it. And I'll tell you a personal story. This was about 8 years ago. I had an opportunity to give, at that point, the biggest talk of my life. It was a big conference for therapists and related professions. There were 800 people there. It was a real step up for me at the time. And I was nervous. I was about to speak before people in my profession, Marsha Linehan, founder of dialectical and behavioral therapy or for borderline personality issues, and then Steve Hayes, founder of acceptance and commitment therapy. You know, you may not recognize these names if you're not a therapist, but in my world, these are like rock stars, all stars. They are the Stephen Currys and Stephen Currys, rather, or whatever, in this world, right? And then it's little Ricky about to go up on stage. And so I was obsessing in the back of the room, you know, outwardly looking all cool in my sport coat. Inwardly, I felt like I was about, you know, a seventh grade, 11-year-old, scrawny, about to speak up and be laughed at. And then I was just, and I was doing all these little mini movies, you know, like, well, I could say it like this, and, you know, that internalized audience, like, and they would love it, or I could say it like that, and they would hate it, or why wouldn't they love it, or me, you know? Like the imagined self interacting with the imagined audience, reverberating. You know, unpleasant, orange, red, flashing, bad. You know, it's like, there I am, sweating bullets, which is, of course, the worst possible way to prepare yourself to give the biggest talk as of that point of your life, right? And so then I was reading in this little flyer, or small little newsletter, rather, some interview with the Dalai Lama. So I thought, man, I got to get my head clear. Dalai Lama, help me now, help me now. You know, I'm sitting there like in the back row of this big room, 800 people waiting for my turn. And I'm reading it and I honestly have no memory of the particular words. And with him often and other great teachers, it's not so much the words, it's something that really just comes through the words very directly. And suddenly what came through the words, there as I was obsessing about how to impress as many people as possible so they would think I was wonderful, like for me, right? I suddenly realized that the kindest thing I could do for me, the most self-interested thing I could do for me, is to quit thinking about me and focus on them and being of service to them, being simple, what's the most useful offering? You know, what's the suffering over there? What's the longing over there? What's the desire over there for something useful? And deliver the goods over there. That paradoxically, the best way to be successful at something is to stop worrying about being successful at something and just focus on being of service for other people. And it's like, you know, this whole thing went through me, and it really shifted me. It's been a major shift for me. Now if I'm doing something, I'll often look at the people there, let myself really feel them, and then move into being of service to them, which is, of course, benevolent, and it's the fastest way to not have stage fright, you know, if you're giving a talk. And I'm happy to say that at the end of my talk, I got a standing ovation, which is really cool. So, yay! Right. It was because I wasn't seeking a standing ovation. I was like out of my mind. I was not in me. I was over there delivering the goods. And if you look closely at so many issues around safety or, you know, fear, anxiety, not always, but often there's a lot of me in there. And see if you can be more aware of that me, try to relax that me. And, you know, as we practice again and again, open out. Open out. Open out into the whole of your consciousness, the whole of your psyche, unfolding, you know, blossoming, you know, moving along, you know, supported by the whole of reality together. And as we do that, you know, we have less preoccupation with self. We get less attached to what I'm going to get out of this or how bad it's going to be for me, 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 me. And we're much more then able to deal with things. Okay. All right. Any comments or questions? And we'll end real close to 8:30. Great.
Rick, earlier in your talk, you were contrasting the idea of being prepared, preparing yourself for positive outcome, and, you know, priming yourself, I think.
Okay.
And then you spoke pejoratively of positive thinking.
Okay.
So I want to know what is the difference between priming yourself and positive thinking, and lastly, what's wrong with positive thinking?
Right. It's a great question. So, what's the difference between positive thinking and priming yourself, and what's wrong with positive thinking? So to be clear what we mean by that, what I was trying to say, and I'm really glad you brought it out, is that, to be clear, I'm not talking about like putting your head in the sand or just locking on to one little good thing and ignoring the totality of your life. That's what I was trying to say about that. And I think sometimes people try to jack themselves up into, and I've tried to do that myself, some kind of this is the best of all possible worlds, or there's something about it. And my observation for myself and other people is it might work briefly, but it doesn't seem to have much traction over the long haul. That's what I was trying to say. I guess the real distinction I could have made better is not so much between realistic thinking and positive thinking, but sort of like between authenticity and fake it till you make it. That's the distinction I'm trying to make. Thanks for drawing that out. So when I'm talking about this priming, the first of those four methods in your brain, it's by leaning into what is genuinely good, what's authentically good. And if you're not able to do it in the moment because you're so upset about something else, or your foot is killing you, or whatever it might be, then you can't do it. But to the extent you can, that kind of authentic, gentle encouragement of a background of well-being or a background, a little bit, of what you're looking to grow. Like, if you're trying to encourage a sense of self-worth deep in your core. I'm talking with someone these days, a woman who really wants to encourage that feeling of being really, you know, a wonderful person, rather than the feeling she grew up with from her childhood of being, you know, always on the bubble, always needing to perform, never really being good deep down inside. If you want to grow, whatever it is you're trying to grow, if you deliberately encourage a background of a super mild version of that, you know, then when every so often, like the real thing lands, it'll land on prepared ground. That's what I was trying to suggest there. And these, you know, you can't do all these methods at once, but these are tools. And I find it quite remarkable to think about how to help yourself be available for beneficial learning and already leaning a little bit in that direction. Okay, yeah, okay. How about first you, then you, yeah. Yeah, that's great. Thank you. Yeah, that's great. That's great. And then here's the question. When that moment of when you use that method, let's say, and that reassurance comes in, what do we do then? Do we slow it down to actually let it land, or do we just move on to the next thing? And, you know, I really should have added that's a fifth factor. It's, if you know my stuff, it's pretty familiar material. Take in the good. Let it reverberate for half a breath or a full breath, you know, half a dozen seconds, a few breaths, you know, one whole cycle, feel it in the body, let it land, you know, do that. Then that each time, episode by episode, will incrementally add the gain from that experience and will encourage the consolidation that starts at the front end of encoding the experience. Okay, good. Yeah, great. And yeah?
Going way back to the beginning of your talk, yeah.
Yeah.
Pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, and relational.
Yeah.
I'm confused about this because the relational one, when it's good, pleasant. When it's either bad or not there, it's unpleasant. So I have trouble seeing that as something distinct. It seems to me to fall on
So I offered this gently. The Buddha did not include it. You know, I'll be kind of quick about it. If you think about it, I think it is really pretty clear that as all animals need to avoid harms, they need to approach rewards, and they also need to attach to others. Now, fruit flies attach in pretty primitive ways, right? Compared to a squirrel or a dog or a monkey or a human being. Like we, you know, so attaching can be very significant. So we have those three primary motivational systems, primary needs. Probably there are certain needs that don't neatly fit in that framework, but it's a nice framework. And it links to the so-called triune brain, you know, the reptilian brainstem focused on avoiding harms, safety needs, the mammalian subcortex focused on rewards, satisfaction needs, the primate human cortex focused very much on connection needs, on attaching to others. Okay. Those motivational systems, if you think about it, the avoiding harm system is triggered by the sense of things as unpleasant. It's triggered by the unpleasant hedonic tone. Okay? The approaching reward system is triggered by the pleasant feeling tone, opportunity rather than threat. Okay? What triggers the attaching system? What activates it? What's a natural signal inside that we really ought to engage our attaching system? In my view, it would make sense for something to arise over time that's a sense of relationalness or not that doesn't decompose entirely into some combination of, you know, pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. First thought. Second, if only as an aid to mindfulness, really tracking the subtleties of relational signaling, you know, I find is helpful for me. Like when I really think about also the complexity of any important relationship, if you really step back, does it all just boil down to pleasure or pain? Or is there more going on? And so that's, so the point here for me is not to assert it, it's more just to invite an investigation. And I have found that to be quite helpful for me. That's all about it. But that's, and I, yeah. Okay, one more question or comment? Yeah, great.
I just, it's a semantic thing.
Yeah.
Consolidation that you were talking about, is that like processing, like some people process things really fast and immediately, and other people process things after something fearful happens, or some people, you know, have different ways of processing. Is that sort of what the brain's doing?
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, like simple example of this is basically you're in an experiment, you're a college sophomore, you've been paid $20 to do this, and they're teaching you to memorize a list of 10 word pairs. Okay? And then they test you again half an hour later. And then you go home, and then you come back the next day and they test you. And how many of those word pairs do you get? That's a like really basic example. And then maybe you come back a week later. How many of those word pairs can you get if they give you one word and you've got to say the word that was paired to it, let's say. Initially, people can learn those pairs pretty fast, but can you remember them a day later? Remembering is the result of consolidation, which is just the technical term for structure getting more and more established. And this consolidation happens for internalizing personal experiences, you know, like what you had for breakfast yesterday or this morning, right? It also happens for emotional residues, you know, of various kinds. It's just a term. And for myself, I basically think of this as sinking in or being changed for the better in a lasting way. You know, that's right. And so that's the idea. And so from, you know, like, do you want to be enlightened in this lifetime? Well, so I think about it, you know, I'm going to have a certain number of days left, right? Each one of us, hours and days. And if I want to be here, right? If you want to be here, whatever you want to be, you want to be really, really happy, you want to be really, really stably loving, do you want to be able to, you know, love your neighbor as yourself, or you want to be able to turn the other cheek, whatever, you know, how do you want to grow? Do you want to really be profoundly peaceful and content? Whatever you want to be, okay? And I think enlightenment sounds really pretty neat. I mean, there are more people alive today, in my view, that have won an Olympic gold medal than are actually fully awakened. It's pretty rare. It happens, but it's pretty rare. So how cool is that? All right. So I'll finish on this point. It's a way to think about stuff. But whatever it is you're interested in developing or manifesting or being, okay, it's here. Now, way over there, you know, when you're a little kid, from here to there, you know, it's a pretty shallow slope, right? Just a little bit each day. But as the days go by, tick, 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 that's steeper. My growth curve needs to steepen. You know, what's your growth curve? What's your learning curve to whatever you really truly aspire to? And not to freak out, like, it's okay, right? But to ask oneself, wow, how much did I grow today? How much more peaceful did I get today? How much wiser did I get today? How much more resilient did I get today? How much more committed to my sobriety did I get today? How much more patient did I become today compared to where I was yesterday? What's your delta each day? What's that growth curve each day? And how can you steepen your learning curve? That's a lot of what we've talked about today, applied to really practicing with the sense of things as unpleasant related to needs for safety. Because we can't do anything about the past. The only real question is, what's my delta today? What's my growth curve today? Downhill? I'm even more of an asshole when I went to bed than I was when I woke up. Or just flat, you know, whatever, man, meh, you know? Or did I actually grow in some way today? Or even better, did I learn how to learn a little bit more today? The X factor. That's our opportunity. And we can sincerely, remember that word, sincerity? We can engage that. How can I help myself be affected as much as possible today in healthy, wholesome, useful ways. Okay? How about we just sit for a minute and finish up? May the bell carry you home safely. Take care. See you next week.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. I feel like we should give you a standing ovation.
No, 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 no.